This is Screen Divers. In this week's episode, we are talking about Sinners, directed by Ryan Coogler and released in 2025. This movie is also written by Ryan Coogler, produced by Ryan Coogler, Zinzi Coogler, and Sev Onayanan. And it's starring Michael B. Jordan, Ailey Steinfeld, Miles Keaton, Jack O'Connell, Bunmin Mosaku, Jamie Lozen, Omar Miller, and Delroy Lindo. Cinematography by Autumn Durald Arkapow, edited by Michael P. Scheuer, music by Ludwig Göransson, and produced by Proximity Media and Warner Brothers Pictures. This movie has a running time of 137 minutes. It was made for an estimated budget of 90 to 100 million and it raked $365.8 million and counting. How are you guys?
I'm good. How are you, mate?
And I'm good. It was good seeing you last night, Umba, watching that movie, which we're not going to talk about.
There's a deep breath.
For our listeners, we went to see Superman last night. It was okay. So, quintessential question must be asked. Hey, Ricky, what's this movie about?
Welcome to the 1930s. We are in the deep south of America. It is post-prohibition, and two fellas are trying to make the nightclub of their lives and make a move on, get becoming out of the crime syndicate and more into what they want to do with their lives.
Absolutely.
Oh, wait, vampires.
This is a good movie. Yeah. This is an excellent movie. It's well executed. I thought Ryan Coogler was younger, actually. But hey, black don't crack, right? So he's 39. I had a sense that he was younger. And his approach is very progressive. Yeah. Which it's a reflection on this movie as well. I'm going to start right off the bat by saying that I admire how... Okay, before we even continue, I've been wanting to do an episode of this movie so that I can go and listen to the Horror Weekly episode. Because I want to hear George's take on this, and it was released a while back. So every time I go through the episode, I'm like, I can't listen to this yet. With that out of the way, there are many things to be commended here. And one of them is, this is mainly a movie with a message, but the message, more than one actually, is not pandering ever, ever. And I love that. Every single thing stated in this movie or remarked in this movie is servicing the story. And I really, really like that because they could have gone out of their way to, you know, jam a bunch of stuff in there and they didn't. If anything, the movie has very minor racial undertones for a time in which America was in the grips of a, you know, of changes or upcoming changes. Even like the Klan is... It's there, but it might as well not be there. And I really like that. Like I also at some points I saw this movie as a musical. There's a lot of a musical quality to it. It feels like a musical. There's a transactional quality to this movie. There's money being exchanged continuously throughout. And I might as well remark the fact that Ricky, you know this. I just watched this 2 hours ago, so it's fresh. I don't know. I also like the duality of these two characters. From my understanding, one of them is definitely a soldier and the other one is definitely a gangster. And they're twins. One of them had to go to war and the other one was cutting his teeth in Chicago. And then his brother joined him there. But this division between the two and the unity between the two is so organic. It just obviously we have the same actor playing both, which is another feat within it. Because you might as well see them as two separate, completely separate actors. So Michael B. Jordan has to be commended for this. Phenomenal performances from everybody here, with a few standouts, and we'll discuss this today. But I also, you know, there's little symbolisms here and there. Even the weapons, I'm going to leave that with Steve. Inside the case, there are two rifles, which are Well, so, one of them is an automated weapon. Both of them are automated weapons. And, what are they?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a bar, which is a classic First World War weapon. Mm-hmm. There's also, I'd have to say, the duality of the pistols between the two characters. One's a Colt and one's a Luger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously one is a blue hat and one's a red hat. We're going to talk about color in this as well.
We're going to get to that. Stay on the ground.
Mm-hmm. So, but I did want to just correct you. Both of them were in the war. And that's proposed by the two helmets and the two service tags, which are being worn.
You're right.
Yeah.
But one of them is definitely more of a gangster and the other one's more of a soldier.
Has the silvery tongue. What's the business and all that
and
stuff.
And also, if you look at the hats worn and the suits worn, one worked for the Italians and the others worked for the Irish.
Yeah, and both of them stole from them as well. So
yeah.
Stole from them and left Chicago. So the confrontation was going to come at some point. That's what that case is for. Yeah. Yeah. The movie that's in the back of the truck. Mm. But you can see as well who owned which weapon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you can see that the bar was for Smoke and the Tommy gun was for Stack, right?
Yeah.
Before we start talking about the actual plot, the big shout-out should go to Ludwig Göransson?
Göransson. The soundtrack
And like, he has worked with Ryan Coogler on many, many of his films. But more importantly, he's also now chums with Christopher Nolan and has worked with Christopher Nolan as well. This guy is shooting up the ranks in terms of film scores. He is an amazing composer, an amazing collaborator. This film pretty much shows off his chops as well as his other ones.
It does, and I actually prefer it when he's not working with Nolan. Because when he works, we talked about it before on the show, actually. I was upset because I thought, can Nolan please let this man cook? Because he's trying to make him sound like Zimmer. And you know what I mean? When there's no need, because this guy really knows what he's doing. He's got a phenomenal body of work. But hey, we're talking about, before we even get to the cast, I mentioned the DOP here.
Yeah.
Holy shit, mate. Her name is Autumn Durald Archipel. Fuck me, dude. She's really good. She's really good, and I think her and Coogler work really well together. I was spellbinded by some... Just the fluidity of the shots. There's a lot of little... There's tracking shots in this. There's pulling and pull-outs. And it's just... There's a fluidity that everything, it feels natural. And the camera is actually constantly moving, kind of. But it's not jarring at all.
Mm.
Like, this camera slides closer to the action and away from it. If there's a staticity to a particular shot... It's not, the camera's not intruding, but it's still moving, and it's really good, dude. I mean, this was, you could argue that this movie is very mainstream, because first of all, the mass appeal of it, this is a musical, it's a sexy movie, there's action in it, it's got everything. It's, at times it's funny, it has absolutely everything, and I also really commend how this movie somehow caters to both men and women. It really does. Like, there's a quality. Like, there's a very particular... I think this is lightning in a bottle. And I think Ryan Coogler needs to be very cautious moving forward, because he may have peaked here. You never know. You know, I really hope the bag isn't empty. I really hope this is the start of him pulling away from, you know, doing what you got to do as a director, because... Let's look at his body of work. He's done Fruitvale Station, which, by the way, him and Michael B. Jordan must be pals, because this guy, Ryan Coogler, launched Jordan's career. Without Creed, Michael B. Jordan wouldn't be the household name that he is today.
That's true.
You know, that's the one that... And Creed was directed by Ryan Coogler. You know, yeah. Fruitvale Station before that is prolific as well, because he's made 5-6 movies in the last few years. So you
see with... Ryan Coogler and Michael B. Jordan's relationship, it was all circumstantial, because it just so happened that Michael B. Jordan was coming off some TV projects, and because of those TV projects, he was looking for something to launch him, and what better than Fruitvale Station? And that both of them, after that movie, they were like, we're always going to support each other, regardless.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and Steve, you may have noticed some similarities from a visual flair of this movie, to go back to Autumn's work here as the DOP, as a cinematographer.
Yeah.
She directed Loki, dude. The first season, yeah, was amazing. It's her. That's her.
And they've worked together on Black Panther and other stuff. So there's a shared dynamic in this. And it's so well done. And I don't know if you guys saw Coogler talking about film on the Kodak website.
I didn't see that, but I saw him featured on the Criterion Collection. The Criterion Collection bit? And he talks about, in that one, he talks about his inspiration. And you can see it in this movie. One of the movies that he praised quite a bit is Thief by Michael Mann. And if you've seen Thief, which, by the way, at some point we'll have to cover on the show, there are homages here. But that's a sign of respect, and that's fine. This movie, man, it's so ambitious. And at the same time, it's a rare beast because, like I said, there's a mainstream quality to it. You know, you could be talking to anyone that is even not into this medium at all. And this is one of those times that when they walk away going, hey, that was a good movie, that's a great movie, they're right, which usually isn't, you know, the way. Like last night, for example. You know, went to see Superman. There's a bunch of people going, this is amazing. Like, you don't know what the fuck amazing is.
See me driving down the street. I'm bored with looking good. I got both hands off the wheel. The cops are coming.
So he's also like the two biggest influences on this movie. He's quoted as saying with from Dusk Till Dawn, which we can see straight away, and also The Faculty, which again, The Faculty, some of the key moments we get could be also seen from another movie, which The Faculty stole from. The entire section with testing to see whether somebody's a vampire or not, come on.
The thing. Yeah, maybe a little bit. So yes, absolutely. Testing, there's a bit of paranoia there, you know, who's turned, who didn't turn. Yeah.
Yeah.
I kept thinking of Demony, actually. Demons. People. That's quite a bit, actually. I think he was paying another homage there. But this is another one. There's a level of innovation as well that I would have frowned upon if it wasn't done distastefully. There's a lot of transitions between IMAX and, you know, a regular format that we're more used to. And they are, instead of just trying to hide them, he played with them. Even the bar sliding, that's very video game-like. But it's also, a modern approach. And in this instance, it didn't feel cheap. It just felt right. It just added a level of dynamicity. It was it just made the movie even more dynamic, which is something that it's really hard to pull off. Because usually when you do it, people that do things like this, that they will pepper it throughout the entire movie and then it turns into repetition. Here it's tastefully done.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many little touches here and there. Like, there's almost a post-credit. I hope that most people didn't walk out because it's essential that you stay for the credits start rolling and then you're given something else, and that's something else essential for people to, because it's kind of nice. It blurs the lines between fact and fiction, because that is Buddy Guy, and Buddy Guy has a couple of songs that actually could resemble the rite of passage of Sammy, you know, like as a reflection of his own life when he was younger. There's touches of this. I even liked, what decade are we in? Is this mid-2000s, or is it late 90s, because it feels like late 90s from what he's wearing. It just hit all the right buttons with me, this movie. I think it's quite memorable. There's something about it. I almost don't like the fact that everybody liked it, because usually it's not, when something has that much mass appeal, it can be great, because if it appeals to everybody, then you know what I mean, It's not, we're not in the field of extremes, and usually something is either really good or really bad. And this one is like objectively good, and I think most people recognized it, you know.
Mr. Spader will tell you that not everybody liked it.
Even Mary will turn around and say she didn't like it. Yeah, she came up to the cinema and went, I don't get it, I don't like it.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Steve, when you saw it, because I didn't see it in the cinema. Umber didn't see it in the cinema. But, Steve, when you saw it in the cinema, did you watch it in IMAX?
Yeah. It was an IMAX print. And I loved the depth of field and the change of camera angles probably were highlighted more there. Purely because you can see how they cut between the two sections,
and you can see it as well.
But on a big screen, definitely. I mean, like this is something to be enjoyed. And I know you've got a huge screen, Umber. We're talking about screen sizes.
I went out of my way. Of course, I'm compensating for something for sure. But I went out of my way to create an environment in which I get to decide who I share that experience with. So going to the movies now, it's irritating at best, you know, sometimes. But the sound design in this is fucking phenomenal.
There's two.
It's really good.
There's two sections where they talk about the religion and how this is powerful and various other bits and pieces. And there's a soundscape in the background in two scenes which makes it magical. And it's just, well, you can feel that throughout the movie. You know,
absolutely,
it's great.
Man, there are some killer performances in here, and I gotta say, I have the suspicion that she is British, and I am talking about Annie. Wunmi Mosaku plays Annie. She's Smoke's partner, right? And man, their chemistry is fucking off the charts in this. Is she British? Am I wrong? I think she is, guys, because I've seen her in a bunch of stuff. Like,
she was in Deadpool and Wolverine.
So, yeah, she was born in Nigeria, and actually most of her education was in Africa as well. But, yeah, you're right, because of her filmography, she did cross over from... And she did start in Nigerian cinema, but she did cross over because she was Queen Latifah in Latifah. So she has been working both over in Western and Nigerian cinema.
She's very good. She's very good. Like, I was completely... all the performances of this, I was sold. I was completely sold on them. You know, I even liked... You know, there's one sequence in particular, guys, which is... that's when, it's not even the one that sold this to me as a musical as well, because that's what it is, but... There's a, and I don't generally like musicals, but again, because of the transitions in this are flawless, so it just kind of like a boxer. It just stepped in and out of genres, like, flawlessly. But there's one where the camera is overhead, and it's going throughout the barn, and you'll see, you know, like, that we're traveling through time, we're traveling through cultures, in and out, weaving in and out of it. Somebody take me off tonight. Oh. Somebody take me. There's a guy here that plays a character called Hogwood, played by Dave Maldonado. He was actually a very good character actor. And he's the one, they don't know this, or they kind of suspect this because they give him a warning. He sells the barn to them. They say, I don't want your clan boys coming here after you sold this to us, because we'll shoot them on sight. And you'll know that, you know, something's going to happen later. But I'm, as much as I wanted to see more of them, yeah, and I didn't give a shit about more of a clan presence, for example, because it would have detracted from what this movie's about. This movie's about vampires. That's what this movie's about. That's it. It's a very simple tale. You can inject as much as you want into it, but actually, the movie tried to not cross those lines, like, somehow. And it's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to do because of the setting. It's a hard thing to do because of the time. It's a hard thing to do because of the heritage of the director as well and everyone involved. So it seems to me that either he went out of his way not to touch any of these topics because they are barely there. If you want to see them, I went on social media. There was a lot of people going, oh, this movie has an agenda. Well, that means you're fucking racist. But anyway, it's besides that, and the people saying it had, like, fucking Confederate flags on their profile pictures and shit, like, you completely missed the point of this fucking movie. This is a vampire tale. It's about two dudes trying to change their lives, and, you know, they're on the run. That's what this is about. It's not, that's the setting, that's the time. But yeah, I
they do play with obviously they actually say it's Jim Crow and the segregation, so you've got the two sides of the street, and you get to see that beautiful one cut, which is them crossing the road because the Chinese, the daughter, can actually walk between the two lines. So they own the two businesses on two separate sides of the street. And you can see that cut between it.
Yeah, and guess what? The focus of that sequence was more on the technical side of it than the message. There's no message.
Exactly, but it was a beautiful and the way cut.
It is. It's a continuous take, and it's fucking beautiful. It's really good because it's not insisting upon itself. Like, it happens, and as it happens, everything that is done here is done tastefully. Like I said earlier, there's a how can I put it? Sometimes we watch something like this, and it feels didactic. It feels like someone's going out of the way to prove a point or to show you that they can do something. Here, there isn't a single sequence that feels that way, and there's a ton of skill going into it. And you got, particularly today, when you're making it look effortless, what I'm saying. I'm worried about his future as a director, because how the fuck are you gonna do this again?
I mean, you know, this is the first time he's done an original IP. So Fruitvale Station was a true story. Creed was based on Rocky. You had Black Panther. This is the first time he's gone out of his way to be like, hey, you know what? I want to do a genre picture, and he's done it his way, and it's incredible. One of the things that we haven't talked about is Miles Keaton, or Keaton. I think it's Keaton.
Sammy.
And Sammy. Miles Keaton is, this is a debut for him. He is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember how old he is. He must be, he was 2005, so 20 years old.
Yep.
And his voice, oh my goodness.
Oh my God.
I've been hearing about this one particular young man all day. Supposed to be a bad blues man. Preacher boy, where you at? Come on over here, man. My little cousin, y'all. Watch this.
He's acting it, but he's acting it well. However, I can tell you right now, and I want us to go back to this episode, if there is a Barack Obama biopic, they're going to pick him to play Barack. Guaranteed.
Just because of the voice.
That's the voice. It's the voice that he's putting on.
There's that one scene where he starts singing and they're in the car, and the look from the look he, which so comes
Michael
out,
B. Jordan,
like,
goes,
holy
shit.
Like, but we all do the same take. We all go, holy shit, what a voice.
Absolutely. I was fantastic. So happy to see Delroy Lindo in this, man.
Delroy Lindo.
So much charisma, dude. So much. And even the way he goes out, dude. He goes out in such a heroic manner. Like, when he cuts himself, it's like, oh, who are you? Like, it's fucking great, dude. Oh, man, this movie is such a ride. Such a ride. Yeah.
Two other actors that we haven't really talked about are Hailee Steinfeld. And Hailee Steinfeld seems to be going from strength to strength. I know that she has a Marvel career. I know she has a voice for the Spider-Verse as well. Yeah. But thinking of her in True Grit all the way to here, how much she's grown and how much she's learned and how much she's just doing. It's incredible.
She's her a good looking woman so as good. Well, dude. Yeah, but, she's very good.
Yeah, but
well.
Her performance is incredible. You could not feel the switch when she got infected, inverted commas, mm-hmm. infected. And then on top of that, Jack O'Connell, I did not know the guy at all before this movie.
He plays Ramek in such a memorable way, just as memorable as who played the vampire in 30 Days of Night. Can someone take a quick look, please?
I'd have to check that out.
Because people tend to dismiss their performance. It's fucking phenomenal in that. And Ramek is very akin. Very akin. Particularly, there's a... Actually, if there was one thing that was on the nose here, was that sequence. It's when Ramek is reciting the prayer. Go on.
I was going to just say to you, Danny Houston.
Danny Houston was like a reason to watch that movie. But anyway, which is a great adaptation of the comic book, but... You know, if for anyone listening, if you didn't see 30 Days of Night and you enjoyed this, go watch that as well, because you love that as well. It's one of the greatest monologues ever that George always, from Horror Weekly, always talks about. So after you watch that, go and listen to the 30 Days of Night episode on Horror Weekly as well, which is a movie that gets mentioned endlessly on the pod. But about Jack O'Connell, is that sequence when he's reciting the prayer with Sammy, and then in unison, the rest of the, what are we going to call them? The coven, or whatever you want to know. Yeah. A group of vampires, what would you call them? What are they called?
A coven, isn't it? A group of vampires, like a cackle.
Vampires.
A murder.
A murder of crows.
what are they called? School. What are they called?
You were right straight away. A coven? Yeah.
There you go.
Or a brood, or a clan, or a family, or a nest. You know.
Okay, a coven. There you go. Do you know what a group of ferrets is called?
No.
Is it a murder?
A business.
A business of ferrets.
It's a business of ferrets. Check it out. Look it up.
I don't need to. If you're coming up with that straight away, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I ran several unsuccessful businesses in this house. For sure, for years. So Jack O'Connell, I mean, he's great, but I'm again getting the sense that he may start being typecast, and he ends up like Stephen Dorff, because apparently he plays the leader of the Jimmies in 28 Years Later.
I mean,
okay, I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but at the same time with Jack O'Connell. You've got to remember that he started off in Skins, dude. He went into Harry Brown. He did the ITV version of Wuthering Heights. He has done his dues. You know, he has gone through, like, you know, whatever regional theater. He's gone through the Shakespearean companies.
Probably rather, exactly. Yeah.
And if you think he started at the same time as Dev Patel, look at where Dev Patel is now. And the fact that Jack O'Connell is now starting to emerge in Hollywood films, great. Just keep going, mate, you know. So
he's English, he's not Irish. And for a second I thought, oh, this is a guy Irish? Like, he confused me. But he's super charming in this, man. Mm. He does have the quality required for the leader of a coven, right? He's hypnotic. His performance is pretty damn good. When he shows up at the door, the entire thing, and I gotta tell you, I really liked it. And then I'll forgive this misstep, if you want to call it. One of the things that I adored about this film was the fact that, oh look, they're not hammering this on the viewer, because we know that you need to be invited in as a vampire, right? So it happens over and over again, and we're not explained that. And then Anis Carter is given some lines, and basically a role, I think it's very well placed, because it's at a point in the movie in which if you didn't get it earlier, I'll ease you into it now. And because this is a mainstream movie, that's kind of tasteful. But in any other movie, it would have been, oh, now they're explaining to us something simple that everybody should know. But it didn't feel that way. It could have easily crossed that line, and it didn't, right? Because she explains it to one of the people. She explains it not to us. Like, it's not an explanation, but she's easing people that are panicking in this scenario into an understanding of what's happening. And in fact, if it wasn't her that had the knowledge of going, these are vampires, then it would have been, what the fuck? but it's the only person there that has some kind of knowledge related to the occult, related to the supernatural. So her guidance is actually needed here. Even the juxtaposition of little things here and there and how they service the story, like even if they are tropish, like the jar of garlic. Oh, vampires hate garlic. But then that leads to them understanding the guy they threw out. You know what I mean? That entire sequence is following a thread, yeah? Then it connects to the beer, whatever. So it's so tastefully done, man. You know, and if you think about it, when you take these components out, they're all simple pieces. The movie is not complex. This is not a complex story. And even the execution is not that complex. With the gear that we have available today, from a technical standpoint, there's a lot of stuff that you can do if you add a little bit of know-how. But it's just how it's tastefully put together. There's a cohesiveness to this story that could have easily gone off the rails. You know, the first act is tight. The second act is tight. The third act is tight. The movie is tight. It's just an anomaly. It's an anomaly to make something that is mainstream. Then I used the word memorable earlier. Maybe it won't be, all right? But for what it is, it's... man, I'm more surprised of how good it is because everyone was fucking saying that it's good. And it, you know what I mean by that, right? You do. So...
But there's particular attention to every kind of detail in this movie, whether it be lighting, whether it's the casting, whether it's the costume design. I'll get onto a bit of that because there's a bit of a Marvel throwback in there as well. But there's a load of attention to detail. And it just makes a complete change to see something which is a good movie, saying people coming out of cinema saying it's a great movie or a good movie and enjoying it. And this surpassed what the box office expectations for this movie were. So, and it's really, really well done.
One of the things to praise here is the amount of restraint shown by its director.
Yes.
But because, you know, all the homages that we're talking about, whatever, I think the movie is about to enter territory like that. And then it steps out. And I'll give you an example. There's a bit when Smoke and Stack are talking through a door. Stack just turned, yeah? He is locked inside the door. His brother goes up to the door, and there's the conversation between the two of them. And there's a moment in which you can see that the editor working with Coogler went, or Coogler said, you know what, cut it here. Cut it here because while we were shooting this, I wanted to do that and I got to do that, but I don't want it to go long enough to feel like I'm plagiarizing something. And that is Jack Nicholson in The Shining when he's locked in the cool room. There is a bit in which if you put him framed, like if you put him side by side, the two movies, there's a shot that plays out exactly the same way. You can see that his head's on the handle, his head's on the handle, the door handle, and you know, in this case, Michael B. Jordan's door head is against the door. The camera's below, and it's exactly. So I'm pretty sure that that took a few takes, right? And then they cut it right before it was too evocative of that. But I saw it. Yeah. So and that's fine because you would, I would, wouldn't you? You would, right?
We got a kicking scene as well.
There's a kicking scene, but and actually that goes on for a long time, man.
Yeah.
And at one point. And I'm glad that it's in the background and it's not in the foreground because that sequence, they start kicking to the beat.
Yeah.
If you, that's the musical quality of this. So, you know, it is the Scorsese kick that we described earlier, but the camera is not placed in the same. But, although it's been kicked to that for an extended period of time, that dude, yeah.
But it's just nice how they turn to the shutters and shut on the beat as well.
Yeah, you can
just see what's going on. It's perfect.
Yeah. Did you pick up on the outfit that... are they meant to be Korean, the couple?
Chinese.
Did you pick up on an outfit? Because it's a little bit of a nod.
Yes. It's a full-on blown nod directly to the blue...
To the air campaign about... Yeah.
It's perfect.
It is. And I like the fact that it wasn't
very
like...
subtle.
Yeah, no close-ups or anything. It's subtle. Like, you know, some people recognize it, some people didn't. Again, subtle. This is a fucking movie about vampires. It's, and yet, you know, like, subtle vampires, I think of Let the Right One In. And even that movie kind of spirals into fucking full-on adrenaline towards the end. You know, its climax is pretty violent. But this one, there's something about it. It's like the pacing is just right. Man, cotton fields never looked that fucking beautiful. Beautiful.
The soft focusing throughout on the 70mm cameras was just—it was such a good choice to have throughout this.
Oh man,
to have that slightly Fresnelled edges to every single scene, kind of adding that dreamlike quality, so that when the vampires do turn up, it's like, oh, cool, all right, we are in this like weird, slightly fantasy world of 1932. As much as there's so much realism about this world and the setting and all of the production, there is that dreamlike quality to almost every scene as you're going through the film. We're looking at an African-American community within the background of what we assume is a very white Caucasian town, but this community is there, you know, even when they go into town, it's highly African-American community. And the vampire, the main vampire, is Irish, an Irish immigrant who is also part of the fringes of America, like when you look at American history.
Yeah,
so you've got two fringe communities kind of clashing. And where the African community's music, and this is me looking way too politically into this, the African-American music is one of the forefronts of this movie. You still find that the Irish punk influence, the Irish traditions come out stronger and envelop more towards the end than...
But you could also see that the community embraced each other's cultures a little, you know, like there's a bit, for example, when they're in the top floor of the barn and the music switches. So vampires are not in the picture yet. And all of a sudden you can hear violin and there's like a little bit of square dancing and stuff. So that makes sense because this is all in good fun, right? That's the idea. That was a place to go and have fun. In fact, I love that conversation about the credits. You know, there's a bit in which it's like, what the fuck? Because they are businessmen. They don't give a fuck about their community, technically. They just want a better life for themselves. This is what the movie's about. And regardless of how they got there. But, you know, then we're going to talk about Smoke's PTSD, by the way. Because it's one of the first things you see at the beginning of this movie as well. You think he's looking at his watch. He's not. He's trying to keep his fucking hand steady. And that hits back later. And that's another instance in which this movie that has to do some hand-holding because it's a mainstream movie. They know exactly who they made this movie for. That's the thing. They made this movie to be palatable for everybody, right? But again, any other time I would have gone, why the fuck are you explaining this to me? It kind of takes away from the story. But in this instance, we have another character that has the right to kind of, because they have history, right? They're friends, basically. It's the Chinese lady that says, "And you're a soldier." You know, like, what's going on? But it's that's... We get the second time of the PTSD, and that line comes right after. So it's explaining possibly who's in that room and us as the viewer, why shaking, just in case you missed it at the beginning.
I just wanted to say, I feel like I'm going to break you off here, so I want you to continue.
What are you going
to
do?
You're
going to break me off?
So, but there's a perfect transition on this movie, which led to the believability of Michael B. Jordan's role in the dual sense, and that was the passing of a cigarette.
Mm.
Oh yeah, I don't think it's a cigarette.
It's a cigarette. Nah, well, let's just say it's a rolly. but the simple believability of that transition and you right seeing that point right at the beginning, and even if it's smoke and mirrors, so to speak, it's perfect. It's the most believable version well done of well. That. Yeah,
it's really well done. Yeah. It's kind of, you know, it's because I was looking.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Also, we all look at these kind of little
fine
fight
details. Sequences between the two of them as well. Yeah. They're tastefully done. Like it's, you don't see it. You don't even think about it. You actually start thinking about these two characters played by different actors almost, which is a fuck. It's rare. Mm. Like I completely forgot. I looked at the beginning when you see that Michael B. Jordan, and I turned around to him and I was like, look, he's playing both acts. You know, he's playing both roles, and that's it. That's from that point on, that thought exited my head and I forgot about it, which is a testament. Because if you see them as two completely separate entities, then well done to Michael B. Jordan. Man.
So the fact that he went through and tried to change his walking stance per character. So he would up his game on one character, like be faster, slow himself down for to play Smoke.
Mm.
And to give the change of persons and personality, and the makeup department made changes to emphasize certain features on individuals as well. I've watched so many documentaries on this morning; it's ridiculous. But it's a testament to the director, to the actor, mm-hmm. to the art department, to costume design, and everybody involved in this movie.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
And if it wasn't for the way the script is, where there is a moment in the first act where you see each character separately, and they are two separate characters, the later scenes wouldn't work. When they're like standing opposite each other, you'd be like, oh yeah, look, it's the same actor again. But no, because you've already been on this little ride with each character separately and found out a little bit about each other's history and how separate they are, no matter, even though they're twins. And again, it's spoken a lot within the interviews that the whole idea of having the twins is sort of harking back to the past of, like, in every neighborhood, there's always the twins. You know, the twins, they're like minor celebrities. That gets mm-hmm. mentioned in a lot of interviews. So, and that's what they are. They're minor celebrities. And they are so separate from each other. So if you've ever known twins, you know they may look alike and all of that stuff. But they're normally very separate.
I dated twins.
You dated
twins.
You dated twins.
Fucking
at the same time,
mate. But anyway, no,
good,
no.
Good.
You have
incident,
some,
but
you that's
have
a
some integrity.
Story.
That's good. Good.
What the fuck do you think you're talking to? I have zero integrity. Integrity.
Integrity.
Integrity.
Integrity. every sound
like
there just flashed through my head. Then.
All right. In regards to this performance, I just want to go and watch Multiplicity at some point with Michael Keaton.
No.
We're not going to do that.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Here's an unpopular thing I'm going to ask.
Mm-hmm.
What didn't you like about this film?
Oh, fuck.
This is akin to the fucking question you asked when we were doing it wasn't Eraser. It was the sixth day.
Yeah.
And you ask, you know, let's focus on the positive. I want you guys to think about
two
positives and a negative.
Yeah.
And it was this moment
and
in which
I reduced it down to
episode.
One positive.
You know, before I did the edit, that pause was much longer. And for our listeners, go listen to that episode. You'll see what I mean. But this is in reverse. Like,
okay,
are you asking
me
first?
I'll start if you want.
Okay.
Because. My
you ask the question, you're going to answer the question first.
Yeah, answer it just to give everybody a little bit of thinking time and whatnot.
All right,
I understand this film, we're probably going to rate it highly and all that stuff. But the one thing that got me was something that Steve mentioned earlier, which Sally mentioned early on during our viewing, which is like, oh, I've heard this is a little bit like From Dusk Till Dawn. And that just started playing in my head over and over again. And so when the vampires came in and they started grouping together and trying to work out how to deal with the vampires, all I could think of was Juliette Lewis, Harvey Keitel in a bar waiting for the vampires to strike. And it is almost beat for beat. And then we've mentioned the thing as well, there were a few elements that were a little bit beat for beat, which kind of ruined the experience for me only a tiny bit. I'm not saying that this film didn't deserve to have a few homages to other films, but during those bits where all of a sudden, oh, there's one person who seems to know a lot about vampires, oh, they're all grouping together to test each other, oh, they're all like gathering stuff together just like From Dusk Till Dawn, and they even had the moment where the swarm comes in like From Dusk Till Dawn, those bits I was like, okay, all right. But then straight after all of this came some very novel ideas and very intuitive action scenes that really work in this film.
So one of the things which kind of ruined this movie for me is basically, I like to go into movies with a complete, I don't want to watch trailers, I don't want to watch everything else. And what happened was, as I was walking into the movie, Mary went, oh, it's a vampire movie. And I went, are you serious? You just bought the movie for me. And because she watched the trailers, and I was just like, I haven't watched any trailers. I knew it was called Sinners. I knew it was based in, but with that in context, and then the Dusk Till Dawn situation. So this was on the day, and it's exactly halfway through a movie we get introduced to them as the club scene, which is perfect to beat with Dusk Till Dawn. And I will say, again, it's a Dusk Till Dawn situation. Mm. Although the movie itself is a very good movie. It's very strong. It's a different movie to Dusk Till Dawn, so I don't kind of say it's a problem. But having that in reflection, yeah, same situation.
I mean, if I was going to peek at it, I'm going to find things that I don't like. One of the things that I didn't like is the very thing that they had to do here, and that's what the very thing that I praised as well. So there's a duality to my statement here, because it's that's where the magic tree comes into place. If anything, instead of cramming, you know, too many messages in a movie that shouldn't be a place for, you know, an agenda or any kind or some kind of sanctimonious message, because that's the way it would come across, and that's the way it came across to some people that are fucking idiots. But I think tonally, this movie does a lot, and perhaps a little bit too much. In fact, there's, you know, for the first 35 to 40 minutes, this movie could be about something completely different. And the thing is, everything is done so flawlessly that you don't actually see the actual turn, which is something that, you know, movies that you mentioned earlier, actually, there's turning points in those movies that are really strong. That's why they're memorable, which is, you know, it's a cheap tactic, but it's part of the core structure of the genre, like of horror, for example. You need to have turning points. Like, you need to have something that goes, because it's either a jump scare or you need to have something so defining that makes the movie memorable. And there's that level of fluidity here. I mean, even the shots, even the transitions between, you know, that musical sequence that we talked about, that's the movie. Mm-hmm. That's the entire movie. Is this, you know, there's a like a very fluid kind of quality to it. It might as well, it's akin to a 2-hour and 10-minute video clip. And that's not a bad thing, like a music clip. You know, it feels that way. It feels that way because it's cohesive enough that you could place it into that box as well. And in fact, both Ryan Coogler and Autumn have a history with music production in general. So how can I put it? I'm pretty sure that the Warner Brothers here gave some pointers. They must have, because that mainstream quality and the sense of restraint, regardless of how good Ryan Coogler is, it's masterfully orchestrated by someone that knows what they're doing, like a producer. Because there's a lot of times here you can see that a brake's been pulled, you know, like a handbrake's been pulled, or someone gave some notes. Because it's too tight. The movie's too tight. That's the thing. you know, and that's how you make something that it's going to be palatable for. So that's the thing that I criticize. And believe it or not, actually, that's big criticism. But it's also what works for this fucking movie. So it's it's weird, man. This is the Captain America Civil War of you know, outside of the superhero genre. It's the movie that a lot of people go, oh my God, that was amazing. Yeah, but it's also a piece of mainstream entertainment. It smells like it, it looks like it, and that mass appeal, it's the equivalent of a Lady Gaga video clip, man. Like, it's I can't criticize it because it sounds catchy as fuck and it's well put together, but it's still mainstream pop music.
Yeah.
So if you really wanted to go there, that's what works against this movie for me.
Yeah.
Right.
I would say the term that they use in Bollywood cinema is a masala film. So it has a little bit of everything for every little audience taste. And that's how I felt a little bit about the final action scene. Let's just call it an action scene. Because I was sort of like, oh yeah, there's not been enough guns in this. And what does Ryan Coogler normally put in a lot of Marvel films? Oh, a lot of guns out of nowhere. You know, oh look, there they are. There's loads of guns everywhere. But again, I think you've hit the nail on the head. No matter how many mainstream tropes are in this film, it doesn't detract from the film at all. Yeah. All the characters have been placed in this in a very tight script. I think the script itself is one of the biggest bonuses of this. However, there are... Oh, hello. Hi, how's it going? Yeah, there are a few people who don't
welcome
seem
to... Welcome, Mr.
Spader. Hello. Some people don't agree with any of the points we've raised. There's a lot of one-star reviews for this this epic of a movie. The first one that I'm going to say is, must be the most overrated movie. If self-importance were a film, Sinners would be the holy grail. The movie is so obsessed with its own vision that it forgets to be remotely watchable. Thank you for that, I96588, done on June 15th, 2025. Another one says, can't believe people like this. I'm out of words. If the state of cinema today, then I prefer to never watch a movie again. Never seen a more idiotic, empty, or boring movie than this. Thank you, All Nothing, 69, May 3rd, 2025. And
what the fuck's it? Hey, whoa. What's his username?
Oh, he is All Nothing, 69, May 3rd, 2025. He is definitely probably an incel. And I'm going to finish on this one,
pounds.
Which is maybe I wouldn't like to comment because have you seen me recently? I mean, no hair.
No, but you don't live in your mother's basement.
this final one, which Rodolfino, I want to go, or Rodolfino.
Giampolito.
A bag. Now, this is something that I think he would have a fight with us because he says, a bag full of nothing, no story, no plot, no emotion, a horrible cocktail. Sinners is clearly a film created by an algorithm that mixed together several blockbuster-type themes in the hopes of creating something. They've clearly forgotten to see the final product before releasing it, and you leave the cinema with a time-wasted feel. It has some good characters, beautiful scenarios, which I just have to say on a side note, he said no story, no plot, no emotion, yet he said good characters, beautiful scenarios, nice soundtrack.
Yeah, okay, well,
badly glued on poorly narrative. On the poorly narrative. I think he means poor
the
narrative,
guy.
But he said poorly, as if
speak.
It's ill. Films should be above all about storytelling, and this film does not have one. Thank you for that, Rodolfino. May 4th, 2025.
Rodolfo Pino likes the smell of his own shoes.
Or his own pee.
For sure. And his room smells like hot dogs.
Man, I have a feeling that actually we should have got our other guest to come in, Mr. Cosby, just to read some.
No.
He was busy with a little bit of raping.
That's all right.
The film is absolutely a train wreck, Kabamflet.
No. Man, you guys were talking about the vampires in this.
Yeah.
Very meaty. And in fact, I wasn't thinking of vampires. I was thinking of Living Dead more than anything, which vampires are Living Dead. But there's a couple of sequences here that were very evocative of Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, and Night of the Living Dead. I think there was homages in there. There's one of them in particular when someone on the ground is being teared apart by a bunch of vampires by the coven. It was really, really hungry, by the way. I want to see more of the actor that played Cornbread.
Oh, my God. So good.
I love that entire bit of indignation, you're not going to fucking let me in. And that's when we're given, when there's a little bit of hand-holding for the audience. That's the sequence we mentioned earlier. For our listeners, if you watch the movie, it's when Cornbread is trying to get back in and they're questioning why can he just go back in on his own, right?
So you listening to this? Woman, this man showed me kindness, employed me, grabbed me out the field. Now he say his brother been killed. The man needs comfort. Not you filling up his mind with that old Louisiana bayou bullshit you on. Now we out here playing games, telling ghost stories in place of doing what we ought to do.
And what is it we supposed to be doing?
Being kind to one another.
That entire sequence is written so that if you didn't know that you need to invite a vampire into your own abode, now you do. Little touches. A thing I liked was the fucking vultures, man.
Yes.
The vultures, which I like a marker. Did I steal this from you, Steve?
Yeah. You stole it from me. I was actually going to discuss the entire section with Jack O'Connell.
Talk about the Corvids.
No, but it's just the simple fact that when Jack originally turns up, obviously he's got an Irish accent, but when he flies into the homestead of the characters we meet at the beginning, mm-hmm. he actually changes his accent to a southern accent, because the Irish were at that time.
Slips out, right? Slips out. I wonder what our Irish friends think of his accent, actually. they may have something to say.
Yeah.
But,
But it's the fact that he changed to a southern accent to speak to the people at the door is perfect, because he clocks the Ku Klux Klan outfit in the background.
Did you say clocks the Ku Klux Klan? How the fuck did you even do that? You want to try again? Because I want to see if you can do it twice.
Ku Klux Klan.
No. He clocks the Ku Klux Klan.
Oh, well done.
He clocks the Ku Klux Klan.
Say it three times in a row, real fast, man.
Clocks the Ku Klux Klan. Clocks the Ku Klux Klan. Clocks the Ku Klux Klan.
Amazing.
But you're the shittiest X-Men out there. This is your superpower, and that's it.
I can pronounce my superpower.
It comes from years.
And it's just this sentence, Ricky. It's just this one. That's it. Which is not a very popular thing to say anywhere.
No. In fact, we've said it multiple times now. It's
you
a
know
problem.
What? The next fucking meeting at work, just go.
By the way, did you clock the Ku Klux Klan coming up the road?
Yeah, he clocks the Ku Klux Klan.
Holy shit, what a way to get fired.
We're probably going to get a lot of southern white people enjoying our
reviews, yes.
Because we've said it something repeatedly.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
That's all right. You're doing well.
Okay, so, but the simple fact that we see the vultures turn up, mm-hmm. not just that time, but on the barn when they arrive as well. Yes. Chacto Native Americans.
It's funny that you mentioned Romero's work, because in my brain, I think because I messed up my brain ages ago on 80s, 90s B-movie cinema, what I was thinking, especially around the vampire coven that started to get created, was more akin to Cronenberg, like something like Videodrome.
Yes.
Or Raven.
You guys kept talking about Dusk Till Dawn, and then I mentioned Romero's work. There's DNA shared there, man. There's Tom Savini. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Again, you know, we have Ryan Coogler looking up to these people, like for sure, for sure. I mean, we are. So I don't see why, and inevitably, the homage would slip in there. So it's a shame when it takes over the entire your entire movie. In this case, you know, but I didn't think about this season. I wish we never recorded this today, because now you're taking me into the Dust Till Dawn territory, which it escaped me.
Okay, I mean, so it's a homage which didn't become fromage.
It wasn't cheesy. Whereas From Dusk Till Dawn is cheesy, and I think that's the juxtaposition. Yes. Is that you know, From Dusk Till Dawn is meant to be pulpy, is meant to be cheesy, is meant to be.
So Mike gets to do it, because that's what you want from it.
And especially you know, with like that whole "Do you want to come in for pussy?" from like Cheech, you know that.
Jesus Christ! Yeah. Yes.
All right, pussy, 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 come on in, pussy lovers. Here at the Titty Twister, we're slashing pussy in half. Give us an offer on our vast selection of pussy. This is a pussy blowout. All right, we got white pussy, black pussy, Spanish pussy, yellow pussy. We got hot pussy, cold pussy. We got wet pussy. We got smelly pussy.
But look, you don't get that here. So, yeah.
If anything, I really hope that my suspicion that someone, like, you know, there's someone behind the curtain here. Someone at Warner Brothers, and he operates behind the curtain, which is probably what's happening here, because the movie's too tight. It's tight to the point of overproduction. If this was an album, it would be Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 by Guns N' Roses. Simply because it is a practical example. And I'll tell you why. You can go online now and check how much fucking money that album made. And you need to remember what type of music that was. It's akin to the Black Album by Metallica.
Yeah,
understand? This is like taking a genre, and now you're not fucking laughing anymore because the analogy is working and stands. You're taking a vampire flick with blood in it, a lot of violence, and you made it mainstream to the point that, you know, Karen in HR is fucking gushing over it the following day. You know what I mean? Karen in HR doesn't watch Basket Case, doesn't watch Reanimator, doesn't watch fucking, you know what I mean? But all of a sudden, she went to see a vampire movie. And this isn't like, you know, you could draw parallels with the fascination that people had with this entire thing. Twilight did it for teenagers. True Blood did it for 20 and 30 somethings, you know, like 15 years ago. But this is different. This is different because it's not as readily accessible as a TV series or whatever. You need to go. People went to the movies, man. People went. This was a date movie all of a sudden, but then it turns into, what is it? What is it, a musical? Is it a fucking horror? Is it like, it's, so someone that knows exactly what they're doing. I love to know that person's name. So it's conspiratorial, it is, but I'm pretty sure, come on, isn't this how Hollywood operates anyway?
I would say, look, personally, the way I see it is that there's one or two horror films every 4 or 5 years that grasp the mainstream. So, for example, we had It recently. Brought in a lot of money, It, and It.
It's not original work, though.
No, it's not original work, but then you also
had...
It's
an adaptation of an adaptation, like it's...
Yeah, but, you know, you had... There's other things. A Quiet Place that brought in a lot of money, you know. And is that horror? Is it more sci-fi? It has horror elements to it. What I'm saying is that I think we're being a little bit facetious around the pull certain horror films pull in, because there are certain horror films that blow the box office without.
Okay, wait a moment, because I'll take you back there. Was A Quiet Place a sexy movie?
No.
Is this a sexy movie?
Yes.
Was Quiet Place a musical?
No.
Is this a musical?
Yes.
Okay. You see what I'm talking about? Like, there's so many... Like I said, it's akin to a Lady Gaga video clip, and that's not an insult. It's like, it's a...
So, we've got a director of one of the highest grossing Marvel movies, which is the Black Panther.
I know, but why are we going back after Superman last night? No, I can't even talk like this, man.
We're
But we have to take that into the zeitgeist of this. The Wakanda Forever. The Wakanda Forever became a gesture.
I didn't think that much of it, to be honest.
You may not, but this guy produced one of the biggest. Assemblage of South.
Clock the Ku Klux Klan.
Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw. Been in trouble with the law since the day they was born. Straightening the curves, flattening the hills. Someday the mountain might get 'em, but the law never will. Making their way, the only way they know how. That's just a little bit more than the law will allow. Just a good old boy.
Ryan Coogler put together one of the biggest assembled casts of actors of our generation for
Black Panther.
For Black Panther.
Yeah.
With a heritage, which was from South Africa.
Yes.
And we basically pushed to have native South African tongue and language used within that movie. But then he's now gone on to do other movies, and
This is what's happening now.
Yeah.
This is it.
This is the movie we're talking about today. This is his
now,
movie.
This is the first step in that direction. Yeah. But I think we're putting too much on Coogler. And I'm telling you, this is a fixer job. This is someone that has coordinated this. So
it's somebody who's brought in a lot of natural talent.
Yeah, but that's the point. We're agreeing. I'm just telling you that I would love to know the name of that person. Mm. I would love to know what that is, because it's not credited in our notes.
I think it might be Ryan Coogler talking to the right people.
I don't think so.
And people wanting to work with him.
You're completely far away from the truth here, because this is a Warner Brothers picture. And Warner Brothers is renowned for calling the shots when they give you their money.
But
yes,
Ryan Coogler had a very, very substantive deal with Warner Brothers on this movie. To the fact that we'll own the rights to this movie in 25 years.
Okay.
Which, for other directors, they don't get that option.
Okay. Guys, the first two vampires that get turned. So the first two, the couple in the house.
I
don't know her name, but she was quite funny in this.
They're both musicians.
Both of them are?
Yeah.
Who is she?
It's Laura Kirk and Peter Dreimanis. Laura Kirk, she has been... appeared in lots of films previously, like Gone Girl and Gemini and Lost Girls. She played the main role in Mozart in the Jungle, which was an Amazon series opposite.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah,
with the guy from Amores Perros.
Thank you. Remember his name now.
We need to do Amores Perros at some point.
Gael Garcia. Bernal?
Yes. Gabriel Garcia Bernal or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. That series was more well known because of the amount of hands that were developing it, including somebody we've mentioned on the show previously, Roman Coppola and Jason Schwartzman. Ooh. Yeah. That was an Amazon production, like on the early Amazon Video days, that, you know, the days of yore where there were only like 3 streaming services instead of 30. Yeah, those days. Peter Dreimanis?
Dreimanis and Lola Kirk, right? Those are their names.
Yeah, so...
couple as well.
Dreimanis is part of an alternative rock band called July Talk, and he is Canadian.
Ooh. Okay.
Yeah. I wanted to actually say something very quickly about that scene, because we keep going back to it. Mm-hmm. There was something very dark about that scene. Did anyone notice it? It was when she walks back into the room and notices her husband on the floor. Anybody notice something dark about that scene?
Yeah, the crypt. The cradle. But
yes.
But there's a cut scene which basically talks to him about they're trying to have a baby. and they haven't had a baby. So I've seen the cutscene.
I think that was like the appetizer before.
That's what I thought. That's what I totally thought. I thought like they never talked about the baby.
It's the appetizer.
Yeah, they never talked about the baby. There was a cot in the background. Oh my god! I thought that was it. They were just skipping over the fact that it was devoured in one go.
No, a
little
cutscene,
a little juice box.
Yeah,
I gotta say, it was a little bit of cringe in one scene here, which is, I said, this is a sexy movie, and even that sexy, but that's also kind of crass. It's when he notices that she's drooling.
Yeah.
Oh.
Spit in my mouth.
Ah, oh, fuck. We're entering porn territory now. So what the fuck's going on here?
I'm going to let you in on something, you guys. Go ahead. I have a huge aversion to saliva. Like, very big.
Listen, this is not about your fucking problems, mate.
Oh, right, mate. Sally,
is that what's going on here?
That scene, and Sally knows about it because she turned around and laughed in my face. When she, like, basically spits in his mouth, I was just like, oh my god, get over.
Do you only let Sally spit in your mouth on Christmas time?
Oh, no, not even then. I don't even, like, if it was one of those kinks, I'd be like, get the fuck out.
And tell me about your love.
Nope, not even then. Nope. It's even worse with my children, because every so often...
No, not the children. No, children.
Even worse, they'll be like dribbling or something, and I will have to get a wet wipe or a kitchen towel and just be like, can I just wipe your face before I go anywhere near you? Jesus Christ, get it away from me. So,
sand, saliva, and flies.
Yeah.
Those are the three phobias.
Sand,
that
saliva.
From.
Oh, flies doesn't fit in with my all the three S's, does it?
No, but we got two S's.
We got two S's.
Sorry, two S's.
SS flies. SS flies.
SS flies. Clock the Ku Klux Klan. Clock the Ku Klux Klan.
Ku Klux Klan with the SS flies.
We asked the question.
Okay. There's a little kind of.
SS flies.
You pay this, my please. God! I'm absolutely sweating in this room.
Anyway,
was it Steve that mentioned the Native American sequence earlier?
Chactos, yeah, Chacto.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man. Like, I felt the tension when he gets to the door, and he's, you know, she looks like she's about to fucking shoot him, and I just thought, don't, please, I want more of this character, but we didn't get to see him. We didn't get to see more of him.
I was hoping they would clean up the vampires at the end.
I was hoping that they would rock up at the end to help.
Yeah, that's what I was hoping.
I would have done that.
Yeah.
I would, and eventually, you know, turn as well. Like, I would have let them in. There would have been an exchange with them. Actually, if it was my movie, I would have had them as the oracles, like as the people that come in giving insight because they are fighting them. You know what I mean?
Fates.
Yeah, so... I would have, and then eventually perishing in the process, right? But they're the ones that give you the tools to go on and succeed, right?
Yeah.
If this was like the typical hero's journey, that's the role that I would have given them.
Yeah.
It's a shame that we didn't. And I wonder if there was a cut of this movie that had them coming
but
in.
But thank God that didn't happen.
Why?
Because
why?
They were clever. They're clever vampire hunters.
Yeah, but
they're like,
I would have given them a harder battle.
Yeah, just but one of their lines is, the sun's going down. Let's get out of here. Mm. Yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. Because they know what's coming, so fair enough. Another tasteful touch, which I love the fact that it wasn't over-explained or anything. If anything, I would have played around with some more mementos, something. I don't know. If anything, I don't think we spend enough time with Ramek in this movie.
Mm.
And that's one thing to criticize here. Because I would have loved to have spent more time with him. This movie is 2 hours and 10 minutes or whatever it is, and... The time was there. Yeah, there was a lot of musical stuff inside the barn that goes on for a very long time, and there's no need because we're already given enough exposition. You already got to do your show thing about traveling through time and cultures, which is a fucking phenomenal. Once you've done that, just give us more of Remick. You know, like, it seems to me that this tale is told inside the barn, like, we, because it's trying, and that's also a service in the story, you know, like, the we're out, you're in, you know, and the protagonists are in, so the story is being told from their perspective. We just get a little bit of interludes outside of the barn, but I would have, even like the birth of the coven, the indoctrination, you know, that this guy is capable of, we got a taste of it with a musical number, because he is charismatic, these people are coming back, so he's got to hold over them no matter what. But I would have loved to have a little bit more of that cult leader kind of indoctrination process to show off. Apparently, we are going to get more. Well, apparently, the movie's already out. I haven't seen it yet. So for our listeners, if you've seen 28 Years Later, I'm pretty sure that that happens there in that movie. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway.
But sorry, you go, Steve.
One of the things that I wanted to highlight is that the song they use when they can rock up to the door is Pick My Robin Clean, which is originally created by two South African South African American ladies.
Pick my Robin clean, pick my Robin clean, pick his head, I pick his feet, I would have picked his body but it wouldn't fit to eat. Oh, I pick my Robin clean, pick my Robin clean, and I'll be satisfied having a family. Lord, didn't that jaybird laugh when I pick my Robin clean.
And I feel like there is this idea of stealing a culture and then turning it to something else. And that's kind of what they're doing with the Vampire Society. You know, it's taking the aspects of those cultures and turning it into something which is completely doesn't have a soul.
Yeah. But I feel like that is part of them trying to get into the barn, because then the big coven song that they do is Rocky Road to Dublin, which is a true Irish song. And all that is showing is more of his, you know, his earlier connections back to his homeland and coming out. I was also going to say that if you want it more Remick, then really, you know, Preacher, Cassidy and Preacher, even Angel.
Oh,
in
shit,
Buffy
I
and
forgot
Angel.
It was in that, man. I forgot it wasn't that.
Yeah.
Completely. Ah, damn it. Right. Who wants to go first?
I'm going to praise this movie. I'm going to praise it down to everything from, like I've said previously, from the actors to the set design to the film work to directors to everybody involved in this movie. I think this is a very strong contender for maybe an Oscar during this year. I feel like it, you know, where it's from a photography point of view or from set design or from costumes. Mentioning costumes, the costumes used in this come from another Marvel movie which never got made, the Blade movie. So that's an interesting tidbit. But because it's the same costume person, and that stuff was from a previous script which was based in the 1920s, so they've managed to offset that and using a different production. But the simple fact that they've managed to get such a great cast in this movie, I mean, it's fantastic. And the cinematography used to create and make a believable set of twins is second to none. Second to none. So that's why I'm rating it an 8.5. And I'm going to call it 8.5 Stakes to the Heart.
Nice.
Cool.
Very cool.
Cool. Ricky.
I gave this an 8.5 as well. I really adored all the elements of this, from the musical elements to the character building to the world building. There is a certain element and charm to 1930s America in cinema that we don't see as regularly as we used to. We used to see a lot of stuff during the gangster eras, during our obsession with American gangster mythology, Al Capone, Boardwalk Empire. And this played a element that I think we haven't seen some great world building like this, like since The Color Purple. I really feel like, though, there were certain elements that kind of stopped it for me from being a 9 or a 9.5. But make no mistake, this is definitely worth your time. This is a sit down and watch. I'm going to give it 8.5 Native American Vampire Killers.
Nice.
Nice. Nice. So this is an 8. That's high praise. This is it's an entertaining movie. It's well made. It looks beautiful. It's well acted. It's entertaining. It's a sexy movie. It's a musical. It's a horror. It's an action movie. It's a gangster picture. It's a period piece. And, you know, it does everything really, really well, but somehow that's also a detractor. You know, it's a great piece of mainstream cinema. That's what this is. And it's an 8 golden doubloons.
Nice.
And I'll throw my factoid in there. No, it's not really a factoid. It's a thing I appreciated because it's the one of the only things we're given that point out the fact that this guy could be centuries old. Like he could, you know, and that's the very thing that makes vampires cool, right? That they've been around for a long time. In fact, the last, you know, dissipating shot of, you know, the vampire's demise with the sun rising is a relief. There's a moment in which it looks like relief, you know, like he tends to, he basically bursts into flames and then it just spirals up towards the sky. But you can see he tilts his head back in what looks like relief, basically. It's over, you know, I can rest now. It's not clean cut, so it's quite ambiguous. So you don't know if it's, you know, if they vanquished someone that just didn't want to go and wanted to reign over everybody. But I think the resolution of this movie is too fast, you know, because we go from a hopeless situation or the prospect of a hopeless situation. And if anything, that sequence that I praised almost post-credit works against the movie as well in that regard. Because, you know, the very notion that vampires would take over the Earth, I mean, at one point, if that's successful, then sustenance would end. Simple. Because they can't reproduce sexually, they can't, I mean, that's part of the, you know, the tropes, but also the rules when it comes down to vampires. And it seems to me that these vampires would kind of respect those rules. Like, we are garlic, and we are, the only one is prayer. It's the one where, you know, those words don't cause any pain. If anything, it's remarked the fact that they can do it. They can, you know. So, it's an 8 golden doubloons.
Nice.
Nice.
Do we recommend this movie?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. And on that note, this was Umba.
This was Steve.
This is Ricky.
Clock.
Clock.
Tick.
Clue. Clock. Clan.
Clock the Ku Klux Klan.
No flies. No sand. No saliva.
Steve.